This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Sheriff Joe Arpaio's in the news again. Now on trial in Arizona for discrimination, we'll talk about the many lawsuits he's involved in.
You might ask yourself, with the open and blatant discrimination coming out of Sheriff Arpaio's office and out of Arizona, how has he been able to continue doing what he does? Perhaps his time of impunity is coming to an end.
We talk with Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of MondoWeiss.net, about his recent trip to the West Bank.
Phil's sense of it, which he reported on Mondo Weiss, is that the place is about to explode, that violence is just barely under the surface, pops up all the time, and that friends of his over there are worried that the Israelis need only one pretext to create another Bosnia.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I think you know that on August 10th, we recognized Agent Orange Day. It was actually the 51st anniversary of the first use of Agent Orange in Vietnam. And many people around the country spent 51 seconds of silence to honor those who were harmed by Agent Orange. And 51 seconds, really, of action to make sure that those victims receive justice and assistance.
The United States, with chemicals that they purchased from Monsanto, that company just won't go away with its GMOs, and the Dow Chemical Company, which also made napalm, the United States used this defoliant chemical to wipe out much of the forest in South Vietnam. They rained down this cancer-causing chemical for 10 years on Vietnam, and there are generations that have suffered from it. Not only the Vietnamese, who have all sorts of terrible birth defects, cancer, heart disease, shorter life expectancy, but also American soldiers who were exposed to Agent Orange. So I was very proud of the Guild for joining with the Iraqi Veterans Against the War and Vietnam Veterans Against the War and the Agent Orange Committee to support legislation to compensate and provide medical treatment to both the American and Vietnamese victims.
Michael, millions of Vietnamese people have died as a result of Agent Orange. And as you mentioned, millions continue to suffer from cancer, birth defects, literally affecting three generations, including babies that are still being born. And specifically, what people are asking representatives to do is to provide health care and social services for affected Vietnamese, to provide medical assistance to affected children and grandchildren of American Vietnam vets, extending the National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study to also assess Vietnam veterans' health, to provide health care for affected Vietnamese Americans and their offspring, and also addressing the first point you made, to clean up the lands and restore ecosystems contaminated by Agent Orange dioxin in Vietnam.
And I want to give a special thanks to Susan Schnall, who was a heroic anti-war figure in the 60s. She dropped leaflets from an airplane on Army bases in San Francisco and was court-martialed for it. She was a lieutenant at that point, and she went on to become a professor and a nurse and is active in the Agent Orange campaign. And she worked closely with our longtime friend and comrade Len Wineglass on that, with Merle Ratner, and they've really done something so important, particularly for those of us who were active against the war in Vietnam those many years ago.
An activist hero. Thank you.
The Agent Orange people have a website. Please go to it. We'll put it up on lawanddisorder.org so you can learn how to support their campaign in Congress to compensate and provide medical care for both the Vietnamese and American victims of Agent Orange.
Michael, we have an update to a story we reported on a couple of months ago. Last week, seven Guatemalans who alleged they'd been the subject of non-consensual human medical experimentation by the U.S. Public Health Service, back in the 40s, appealed the dismissal of their lawsuit to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Their suit was dismissed in June because the court found that under the Federal Tort Claims Act, the U.S. government is specifically exempt from liability for torts that occur outside of this country. In this case, the Guatemalans allege they were deliberately infected without their consent with sexually transmitted diseases in order to test the effects of penicillin. The Guatemalan government had reportedly requested that the U.S. government provide out-of-court settlements before the lawsuit was filed, but the U.S. did not respond except to apologize for the research.
The American Public Health Service conducted these experiments on some 700 Guatemalans, prisoners, mental health people, and they didn't tell them that they were giving them syphilis, but they gave them syphilis and gonorrhea in order to see whether after they got infected, they could give them penicillin to cure them. Evidence of what the Public Health Service did was discovered by a very enterprising law professor, Susan Reverby. And as a result, President Obama apologized to the Guatemalan people. Let's hope the court does the right thing on appeal and grants these people relief.
It's an astonishing abuse of human rights, Michael.
Imagine deliberately infecting 700 people with syphilis and gonorrhea and not telling them about it?
I think we had a lot of that at the hands of this government, not only in the U.S., but in other countries during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Sheriff Joe Arpaio recently went on trial in Arizona for discriminating against Latinos and for usurping federal authority with roundups of undocumented immigrants. In a related action, a coalition of groups is asking a federal court to block enforcement of Section 2B of SB 1070, the Arizona law that compels all law enforcement agencies in that state to enforce the so-called Arpaio model. In June, the Supreme Court rejected the premise of SB 1070 on grounds that making foreign policy, of which immigration law is a part, is a federal government's domain. However, the court upheld the law's "Show Me Your Papers" section, requiring officers to check the immigration status of anyone they stop, arrest, or detain on another basis if that officer has a reasonable suspicion the person is in the country illegally. Plaintiffs are also asking the court to enjoin another Arizona law which turns alleged violations of a federal anti-harboring law into a state crime. Courts have enjoined similar laws in Georgia, Alabama, and South Carolina since, like Arizona's, they were clearly preempted by federal law. Joining us to talk about these issues is Lena Graber, a Soros Criminal Justice Fellow who focuses on detention and deportation and state and local law enforcement. Lena, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Sheriff Joe Arpaio is continuing to be in the news, and we had a Supreme Court decision rejecting the premise of SB 1070 based on the preemption doctrine. But the court upheld the law's Show Me Your Papers section, requiring officers to check the immigration status of anyone they stop, arrest, or detain. So can you talk a little bit about what that means for everyone right now?
Yeah. It means there's a lot of panic in Arizona about what exactly is going to happen and what does that mean for someone who has ambiguous immigration status if they're stopped by the police. How long are they going to be held after whatever they've been stopped for has been resolved for the police to check their status? And as we know, the law enforcement, certainly in Joe Arpaio's district in Arizona, have been really outspoken about their intention to stop Latinos and fight immigration. And so the issues around racial profiling are really huge. I think it's worth separating out the different lawsuits that are going on because it's really confusing.
Exactly.
Yeah, we wanted you to do that. We had the one in the Supreme Court, which I think we've covered with our listeners, and they're familiar with it knocking out a lot of the law, but not the Show Me Your Papers part. And now there's at least two that are going on in Arizona, if those are the two that you're referring to, I think, right?
Right. So it actually goes like this. There's Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is this kind of crazy megalomaniac who runs this incredibly punitive jail where they barely feed people enough, and it's like 120 degrees. And he's been sued literally thousands of times for the conditions in his jail in Maricopa County. And that's been going on since he was elected in the early 90s. In the last several years, maybe 10, he's really gotten on this tough on immigration, let's do sweeps through the Latino neighborhoods campaign. And as a result of that, the ACLU and Somos America and some other civil rights groups filed a civil lawsuit against him and his office for racial discrimination and violation of equal protection and violation of people's civil rights. They filed that in 2007. About 6 months later, the Department of Justice initiated a civil rights investigation into Joe Arpaio and his operations in Arizona. And after a three-year investigation, they also sued him. They made a finding of violations, and they also brought him into federal court. But it is the civil rights groups, the ACLU and Somos Arizona, that are on trial this week, which is why he's in the news, because he's actually testifying about the operations in Arizona. In the meantime, after that had already been building up, in 2010, the state of Arizona, in which Joe Arpaio was quite popular amongst a lot of people, the state of Arizona passed SB 1070. Immediately after SB 1070 was passed, both the ACLU and the National Immigration Law Center and the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund filed a lawsuit claiming that that law was unconstitutional, and the federal government also sued claiming that law was unconstitutional. So in both of these tracks, one against SB 1070 and the Arizona law, and one against Joe Arpaio and his racial profiling and civil rights violations, there are both civil rights groups and nonprofits filing one lawsuit and the federal government filing a sort of parallel one. The only thing that has been decided so far is the Supreme Court recently ruled on the Arizona law, not on Joe Arpaio. And that was the decision that came out and has been discussed, where they struck down most of the law, but they upheld this show me your papers provision, which basically requires police anytime they stop someone, and if they have reason to believe that the person is undocumented or in the United States without authorization, to check their status with immigration.
So let's stay on that case for a second. They went to the Supreme Court. They knocked out most of the law, except for the show me your papers. Mm-hmm. And they said on show me the papers that you can come back to us if you can demonstrate that it's being applied in a discriminatory fashion, or roughly that. You'll know it better than I. But even though they just decided that case in the Supreme Court, there's a current challenge going on in Arizona saying we don't really have to wait to show that it's discriminatorily enforced. It is being discriminatorily enforced, or something like that.
That's right. It's really weird. There's two pieces to that, I think. First, the Supreme Court basically said we don't like a facial challenge to this law, which means we think, in theory, it could be enforced without racial discrimination, and so we're not going to say it's unconstitutional before it even gets going, so we'll wait and see what happens, is sort of what they said. However, it's really important to notice that the federal government did not argue that the law was unconstitutional because of racial discrimination. They not only did not make that argument, but there was some discussion at the oral arguments of the Supreme Court about how racial profiling was not on the table, right?
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, which is, I think, as a side note, it's a really interesting question why they made that decision. I think there's a lot of politics behind that. But at the same time, that other suit against the law, which was filed around the same time by the ACLU and other civil rights groups, that suit has always made the claim that this is unconstitutional because there's no way to carry it out without blatant racial profiling and illegal civil rights violations. And so they, shortly after the Supreme Court decision, they filed a new motion for injunction specifically against that provision 2B that the Supreme Court passed on, that they said was okay. And the civil rights groups argue, no, this is really a major civil rights and equal protection problem. There's no way that we can let this law go into effect. It will be, egregious violations of the 14th Amendment. And so we think that on the grounds of equal protection and racial profiling problems, that provision still needs to be stopped. And they have a lot of claims about how many civil rights will be violated, and so it needs to be put on hold.
Given all the pending lawsuits, even though the sheriff enjoyed relatively broad support among law enforcement, are there any indications that pending litigation has changed law enforcement's responses?
I think it Some of that remains to be seen on how the trial goes, but I'm sure litigation tends to affect the way that law enforcement operate pretty dramatically. I will add that certainly even in Arizona, although Joe Arpaio has been tremendously popular amongst a lot of people and has been reelected 5 times, he's had his opposition, and, for example, the chief of police in Mesa, George Gaston, has always opposed him and said, listen, I need to build trust with the Latino community. They can't see us as the enemy. That's really destructive to our general policing power if no one will call the police to report crimes or if they're a victim, etc. And so he has always distanced himself considerably from Arpaio and the super tough cowboy sheriff approach.
I want to try and get some timing from you. We now have these two cases going on. The federal case, discrimination case against Sheriff Arpaio for discrimination and how he's enforcing the law against particularly Latinos. And you have the case trying to knock out Show Me Your Papers again based on its discriminatory enforcement. In the first case, the one in which Sheriff Arpaio is a civil defendant, I presume.
That's right.
The case is actually currently underway. And what do you expect to happen? When's the outcome? Is there a jury? What's going on?
I do not think there's a jury. And again, there's two cases against Arpaio. So the one that is on trial, literally before a judge, people testifying in court, bring evidence of all these horrible things that Arpaio has done to the people in his jail and the people in Phoenix or Maricopa County, was brought by the ACLU and Somos America. And they are seeking an injunction against his policies and declaratory relief that he violated people's rights. The federal government has been very slow on the game to chastise Joe Arpaio.
You know, I've been shocked by how long it's taken to put Arpaio in the court. It's been years of going on, and you can see pictures of that detention facility outdoors and tents and people sitting there. And go back to that, because I can't understand how someone so clearly violating the law has been allowed to continue doing so.
Well, neither can I, and certainly neither have the activists in the community in Arizona that have been protesting his behavior for years. In 2005 or 6, Arpaio started to get particularly notorious. And it's worth mentioning that in 2007, the Department of Homeland Security formed their largest 287G agreement with Sheriff Joe for his deputies to be trained to enforce federal immigration law. And at that point, the violations really started to go through the roof, and it was shortly after that the ACLU and Somos lawsuit was filed, the one that is now on trial.
So initially, really, the federal government had a big role because they trained him.
That's right. And they encouraged him, and they refused to drop that agreement until just last December, following the Department of Justice's very drawn-out 3-year investigation to figure out, was Joe Arpaio doing something bad?
So now we have that trial, and hopefully we'll get an injunction out of that trial.
That's right. And then the Department of Justice, following their long investigation, did also file a similar suit, but it's not nearly as far along. It was just filed a couple months ago.
Oh, I see. So this suit, the initial suit, is by the ACLU and Somos, right?
Exactly.
And then the federal government came in after. So even till very recently, the federal government did nothing here.
That's right.
Okay, so that's that lawsuit, and that hopefully will push Arpaio back, we hope. And then there's the other one is the one challenging Show Me Your Papers. And is there anything going on in that? I mean, there's a lawsuit that they filed. Is there a trial date? What's going on?
I don't think there is a trial date. It's sort of trading briefs about different issues at this point. They just filed a motion to, and by they, I mean the National Immigration Law Center and the ACLU and MALDEF, filed a motion to put 2B, the Show Me Your Papers section, on hold even after the Supreme Court's decision, saying we have arguments in our separate lawsuit that this can't go into effect.
That's great, because I know it was on hold pending the Supreme Court decision.
Exactly.
That's the Show Me Your Papers provision, and now, of course, it's going to go into effect without this further litigation.
That's right. And I think discrimination suits are really hard to prove, and the courts are reluctant to see things the way they are. But I'm personally optimistic. I think that if any law has a strong case, it's SB 1070. I mean, not only is it sort of really difficult to imagine how the law could be carried out without blatant racial discrimination. The legislative history and the emails of the legislators that passed it are also quite condemning of their motivation, and that plays into the way that the law is challenged.
Well, Lena, this was a really informative interview. Thank you very much, and I know you're involved in many ways in Arizona as well as throughout the country, but good luck in Arizona.
Thanks, Lena.
Thanks so much.
We welcome back returning guest Phil Weiss, the founder and co-editor of Mondo Weiss. That's at mondoweiss.net, a news website devoted to covering American and Israeli relations. Phil has recently returned from a trip to Israel. We talk with him about that trip and what he thinks about the future of the Palestinian people.
Phil, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here. I love it being here.
We love having you. We understand you've been several times to Israel and the West Bank, but you've just come back from a recent visit.
That's right.
And we wanted to start by quoting you. You said that you came back with an overwhelming sense of darkness and martial law. What was it like? What did you see?
I guess, you know, the thing that freaked me out, I mean, the last few times I've come back, I've felt a real sense of bleakness. The last time I went there, a friend who works at the UN was saying that friends back in Europe are always asking her, what's the peaceful resolution of this conflict? And she just says, there's no peaceful resolution of this conflict. I mean, it's so despairing. When you're there and you see just how much force is arrayed on one side and how the status quo is really one of just complete inequality, it's very it makes you think of the worst moments in our history, world history. But to your question, you know, one episode, I was just driving, it was Ramadan, and I had broken iftar fast with a friend who's a Muslim at his family's house in a very privileged section of East Jerusalem, and he was driving me back to my hotel in the old city, and, you know, just a nice neighborhood, and suddenly there's a Israeli Jeep that sort of stops in the middle of the intersection, and these guys jump out and they grab a kid off the street and drag him back to the Jeep. And that wasn't the only episode I witnessed, but the sense of occupation, the sense of martial law is just so overwhelming that it's very hard for an American. I'm a privileged American. You know, I'm a very lucky person economically and where we live, just to observe these conditions. And at a time when, you know, there are liberation movements across the Arab world that are just incredibly exciting. And there's a lot of terror and despair around those, but they're exciting. These are really positive movements, I believe. And to be in a place that is just so defensive about all that and so afraid and so locked down, spiritually, it's just, I don't know, it's awful. So,
Phil, the two-state solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict is still being touted here in the United States. But I think the reality is something else, and I wanted to know what your impression was after coming back about the two-state solution. How real is it? Who still believes in it?
Well, as you observe, to be taken seriously in the American mainstream, you have to be for the two-state solution. And presumably Obama will make that statement, and maybe even Romney will make that statement in the upcoming debates. But I think that when you're over there, you see that there's very little left in terms of contiguous territory in the West Bank to create a viable state. So this whole idea of creating a viable state is one that now involves, you know, underpasses, bantustans, sort of roads connecting, transportational contiguity. The whole idea that, you know, not only is it a gerrymandered territory, but to get from one part of it to another, you know, there would be a roadway or a tunnel underground. It just doesn't make, and you see the settlements just all around you. You see these settlements with like giant swimming pools next to villages with walls around them to separate themselves from Palestinian villages in occupied land. The experts I trust there, I mean, don't believe it's possible. Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition says it's dead. And one of the two-state solution, one of the great things that I think happened while I was away was that the New York Times published this article by Danny Dayan, who's a head of the settlers council saying this land is ours, we're never going away. And it was a good op-ed in that it showed what the political reality is in Israel, which is that the power structure is now solidified behind this idea that Area C, close to 60% of the West Bank, which has slowly been Judaized. There are more and more Jews in Area C in the West Bank, and there are fewer and fewer Palestinians. They've been moved out of Area C. Area C is ours, they say. And so if you look at the map, you can't create a viable two-state solution when Israel annexes that territory, which it's bound and determined to do. And the fact that the New York Times is stating that is helpful in terms of our discourse here, because clearly on the left, we've been aware of this process for some time. But it's beginning to break in on our quote-unquote leaders.
What do you make of recent subway or bus campaigns that we've been seeing, I think, on the West and East Coast that are very either pro-Israel or anti-Arab? Do you see sort of a renewed effort on the part of some people in this country to reinforce stereotypes?
Oh, I think absolutely, Heidi. I mean, it's very distressing to see bus ads in San Francisco that say that Muslims are savages in so many words. And on my commuter platform coming in today to see one saying that it's not Islamophobia to blame Islam for terrorism. I mean, the forces of reaction are very strong in our country, and they've been at work, on this question for many years. I mean, I'm such a positive person. I'm a little bit of a pangloss that way. But I guess I'm hoping that this exposes some of the extremism, that it is extremism, it's intolerance, it's racism, it's statements that we would not accept, that have become off limits in American discourse in almost any other context. You're not, people are making in this context. Like Aaron David Miller saying in the New York Times yesterday, there are too many Arabs and Palestinians in Israel for there to be a Jewish future. You know, how can you make that kind of statement?
Pardon me, but I've only been here for 2,000 years.
Yeah, right.
You know, what's so alarming is this dehumanization of Arabs, not just Muslims, because a lot of Arabs are not Muslims, because the dehumanization of people is a prelude to something else. We certainly know that from being Jewish and having relatives in Europe. And it seems to me that the same thing is going on over there and here too. What could become of it is really scary.
But Michael, how long do you think that process has been going on with respect to Arabs and Muslims? Is it decades or is it?
I got a few years on you, Phil. So
yeah, a couple.
I was over in Israel in 1959 when I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And, I was a kid from Milwaukee. I didn't know anything. But I knew enough to know something was wrong. And there was a real sense of prejudice against Arabs, a racist attitude against Arabs. And I could sense that. I think that has been cooking since all the way back to when Israel was established on their backs in 1948. And then it was extended even further in 1967 when they captured the West Bank. And I think that people have to be dehumanized before they're displaced.
Uh-huh.
And that's the process I see going on. And I wonder what kind of things you saw when you were over there just 2 weeks ago.
Well, I mean, the one thing that always strikes me when I'm over there is the separation, the complete separation of two societies, that you see utter and that allows the contempt to increase. I mean, if you're in West Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and at the airport even, you don't see Palestinians, you don't see Arabs by and large at the airport. And my friends who live in the occupied territories avoid that airport at all costs. They feel racist humiliation when they go to that airport. So here's a place that I actually, frankly, feel pretty comfortable at, the Ben Gurion Airport. I'm an American Jew, and I'm welcome there. And yet there is really a sense of kind of ethnic purity at work. I think one of the things that struck me really, again, to go to Ben Gurion, is as you leave the country, you pass these beautiful posters from the Israel Museum of sort of beautiful artifacts they have of Israel's history, or the region's history, including Persia and Egypt. And As you're walking down this, I don't know, the 30 of them, you realize there are going to be no Palestinian images. The word Palestine will never appear in any of these captions. And it's obviously different from visiting someone's house in East Jerusalem, a privileged Arab family where they've been had to move there because they got kicked out of their last house in 1948, and their backyard has lately been cut in half because Israel decided to build a settler's road, and they just announced this one day. That's physical displacement. That's, you know, to then see this kind of artistic, historical displacement, that so that it goes to the core of an ideology.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. It's plain to see that is what they mean. Madness, madness, I call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. I'm about to explain that someone is using his brain. Madness, madness, they call it madness.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Philip Weiss about his recent trip to Israel.
I think you and I could have an interesting conversation about the good things that may have been in Zionism, that there may have been good impulses or understandable impulses on the part of Jews in Europe, that it may have represented a liberation movement at times for Jews who were oppressed. But the way it's worked itself out, where there's just the denial of that humanity is just so profound and offensive. I felt it was almost like hate speech to walk through this exhibit. So,
how would you measure the sentiment on the part of Palestinians generally toward the United States and to Americans who come to visit?
Well, my experience has been so positive that it's hard to see that as and that's been true throughout the Arab world. I've been struck by the, you know, famous Arab hospitality. I mean, there is a tradition of hospitality in that region, and people have always been welcoming to me. They've always wanted to talk about injustice, and they regard the United States as one of the authors of that injustice, but they seem to, you know, individuals, they cut a break. I think that there is some hope that I'm very positive, but the idea that we have symbolized to the world certain positive developments in terms of freedom, human freedom, that there's a hope that that will extend to Arabs and Muslims. I mean, I always think, you know, Michael wrote this book about lawyers, and there's this section where William Kunstler talks about the annoyance of someone saying, you got to stop in Montgomery on your way back from, I forget exactly, it was in 1961. And Kunstler has a lot of things to do. He's just gone out to California to represent. And he stops in Montgomery and he realizes this is where his life is going to be now. He walks into the bus station and sees the racism. And he sees the people who are getting arrested for merely sitting at a lunch counter, and he says, this is where I have to be. And I think that that kind of American idealism that he represented, that's something that Americans of good conscience are going to be called to this region for the same reason.
talking about those small daily examples of racism, in addition to the sort of housing issues, what would one see, say, going to the stores or in the streets on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I was staying in East Jerusalem, and not far from the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Muslim quarter. And so I found it kind of powerful that when I would be in these Ramadan crowds, which are quite frightening, actually, because there's such a surge of humanity. I mean, everyone's well-behaved, but you're just really packed in. And I was just really struck as I was in these crowds that over our heads were these Israeli flags. And they represented settlers who had moved into the Muslim quarter and were evicting Palestinians from their houses. And so the sense of sovereignty, of Jewish sovereignty, and there's the Jewish star, the sense of sovereignty is very profound. And I think that it has... Ramadan is a celebration. It's a great celebration. People have turned day into night. I'm at the Damascus Gate. Everyone's celebrating. And suddenly this Israeli jeep flies up behind a crowd of line of cars and just starts hitting its buzzer and its siren. And again, the sense of sovereignty is and domination is profound. You're walking through the old city and, again, Ramadan. I was in Hebron. People are going to the mosque of the Abraham's Mosque. You see them coming out of their city, the old city, and the men are putting on their belts because they've just been searched. They're in their city and they're not allowed into this quarter where Jews are without being thoroughly searched. And the opposite does not happen. So there, everywhere you go, you have a sense. It's hard sometimes to meet people's eyes because you feel that you are an author of their humiliation, and this human being with a lot of dignity has suddenly been humiliated before your eyes, and, it's upsetting.
If the two-state solution is dead in the water, what do you think of the notion of one person, one vote?
I think that that's a very powerful notion. I mean, it's a really powerful notion. And Michael, you remind me of a conversation I've had with, intelligent people over there understand the two-state solution is over, and they have to live there. And they are grasping, this has been a paradigm that has governed their lives for the last 25 years, two-state solution. And so suddenly for that to disappear, it's easy for us to talk about this in the United States, but they're living it, and they don't know what's coming next. And they're in a state of some apprehension about this. And actually, one of my Israeli friends, who's married to a Palestinian, a very unusual situation where you see actually an Israeli married to a Palestinian, this person says, one person, one vote. Why don't you start campaigning in America? So I'm really glad that you said that, Michael, because I think that's a very compelling principle.
Well, it's a principle that we all believe in America and are still fighting for. And I don't know why it couldn't obtain over there, except that I think that these Israeli chauvinists would view it as an existential threat, that they're a minority in that whole area, and that to give the Palestinians upon whom they settled an equal vote would threaten them.
Yeah, I mean, my friend said, I said, what if that campaign got traction? How would Israelis feel about it? He said, it'd be an existential threat.
Yeah.
So then you have to reflect about what kind of society regards that principle as an existential threat. I mean, you and I both are John Brown fans. John Brown always said that the idea that all people are created equal is the exact same idea as do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That these core principles, every one of them is offended there at every turn, and it would be great to have them expressed in an American campaign, and I think that may happen.
Yeah, no, it offends the central precept of the very religion they claim to embrace.
Mm, that's true. That's true.
During your recent visit, didn't you see the fundraising entourage of Mitt Romney?
Oh, yeah, I did. That was kind of funny. I went to the King David Hotel a few times when Romney was there and was doing the fundraiser. And so it's kind of scary to think that a bunch of Americans would have to go over to send a signal to Obama. They would go over to raise $1 million at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem and have Romney talk about Iran and he's with Netanyahu on Iran. I mean, these were sort of powerful political signals that were being sent while I was there. And it was all American. I mean, everyone I met there was an American. And they were all just, you know, it was all aimed at Obama. So,
Phil Weiss from Mondo Weiss, do you think that there's a likelihood that there's going to be an Israeli attack on Iran? And if so, whether it would be before or after the elections? I mean, what was it that Romney was over there trying to do? And what are the Israelis trying to do, both the political establishment and their security establishment? What do you think the future holds with respect to a war against Iran?
Well, Michael, I would emphasize on my expertise, I don't hold my expertise out as any as significant here. I'm reading what you all are reading, and I mean, I'm reading a lot of it because I'm so concerned. I guess the simple ideas that have arisen from some of the conversation are, I think Romney is behaving in an irresponsible manner. I mean, he doesn't seem to fully understand what's going on. He's being used in this. It seems like he's being used in this situation. The Israeli security establishment, there is some sense that it does not want this attack. I mean, there have been reports in Haaretz and elsewhere that they are, most of the security establishment says it's not going to achieve anything. And yet, the politics of this seem to be the most important element of it. And the fact that I think Romney's going to lose. I think part of his errors, his international errors, have embarrassed him. And the likelihood that Obama is going to win, which I think increases the likelihood of an attack, because Israel thinks post-November we lose our we have much greater leverage over Obama in the next few months. It's like cast lead. Obama, before he was president, was not in a position to criticize Israel and Gaza, and Israel wrapped that slaughter up before Obama became president. And similarly, in this situation, if Obama is reelected, I think that he'll have much more autonomy. Before the election, he's got to play to his domestic needs. He hasn't said anything. Privately, it seems he's working against an Iran attack, but it seems like he doesn't have that much power over it, that there really is a force toward, obviously he has a lot of power, but that Netanyahu and his defense minister, Barak, really think they might get something out of such an attack and are pushing for it. So that's my interpretation, but I'm curious to hear yours.
Well, I share yours. And what concerns me with respect to the Palestinians is the pretext. The same use of a pretext, say, in saying that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Yes.
They could use, because if they attack Iran, Iran's not going to sit still for it. And I think that could be the pretext for the Israelis going after the Palestinians.
Yes. That's an important part of the analysis that I think most global analysis overlooks. Moshe Makover, a longtime socialist in Israeli society, has said that they don't care about Iran. They care about cleansing the West Bank of Palestinians. They care about their greatest fear is a demographic threat, that they're going to lose the Jewish majority. And if there is a war with Iran, that's a perfect opportunity in a crisis to push more Palestinians out of Area C into the cities. I mean, it's horrific, but we've seen a lot of horrific stuff there before.
Let's talk about what we can do about it. BDS, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. It's a nonviolent movement that's really gotten traction.
Yes.
What was the sentiment over in Israel about BDS and the kind of support we in America can give the Palestinians here by using it?
Well, I think that I agree with you that that's something we can do, and that's why I am for BDS personally. I every time I go there, I'm so upset by what I see. That I think about what my mother did around when Cesar Chavez asked her to take action. I think what she did when people were trying to desegregate the South asked her to take action. She did simple things like boycott as a good liberal American. And this is really all I can do. I mean, or I can do a lot as I'm a journalist, I'm engaged, I'm talking about it, I do a lot, but this is something that we can do, is that they've asked us to do this and we should boycott. I don't know how effective it is right now. I mean, in terms of, it is gaining traction, but but it isn't commanding quite. The question is whether the South African narrative is kicking in. Are we on a South Africa curve where their boycott played a really, I think, a really important role? I mean, you may know better than I did, but I think it did play this significant role in isolating South Africa. And is that going to happen? I think ultimately it will, but I don't think it's happening at quite the speed that it happened in the South Africa situation.
Phil, tell us about your website, Mondo Weiss. How can listeners get there?
Oh, you know, they'll find it on the web, mondoweiss.net. It's a website that is it's about the Israel-Palestine question. It tries to cover a lot of news on the question and even break news on the question. And generally, the two co-editors, myself and Adam Horowitz, are left-wing Jews. Although we try to represent a very universalist perspective, we do come at it as Jews who are disturbed by what Zionism has done to our community. And that is it good for the Jews question that is at the heart of Zionism, that people should be acting out of sort of ethnic supremacist motivation.
And what kind of criticism, if any, do you get on a regular basis?
I get a lot of criticism from Jews for exposing my people to danger. So that Sheldon Adelson, whom I met at the King David Hotel, supporting Mitt Romney, has said that the two-state solution is a stepping stone to the destruction of the Jewish people. So that type of hysteria, that's hysteria. That's just pure hysteria, because if you see what's going on there, we're talking about the destruction of the Palestinians, but that type of hysteria, which I think is born of the Holocaust and of a lot of historical trauma, is very deeply inscribed in my community. So I face that type of reaction all the time, that you're naive.
I think that Sheldon Adelson is the personification of the corruption of anything that might have been good about the Jewish people. He's truly, literally a casino capitalist.
Yes.
Here's a billionaire who's bilking poor people in Macaw.
That's a good
bribing
point.
The government of China to do it.
Wow.
And then funneling the profits into the most
wow.
right-wing politicians here in the United States. He really is a disgrace to the Jewish religion.
I think you're right, Michael. I wish I would have been so forceful. It's well put. It's well put.
You know, Phil, talking about the scene at Ben Gurion Airport, last time I was there, I was with a delegation of National Lawyers Guild people to investigate the Israelis picking up and literally setting out into the desert various Palestinian leaders, not just political leaders. They're very conscious, the Israelis. They were picking up cultural leaders because they wanted to just cut off the head of the Palestinian community.
Interesting.
So we went to investigate on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild. Abdin Jabara organized a delegation, and one of the people that he asked to come on our delegation was Wilhelm Joseph, who's at that time was the head of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. He had been in training for the Olympics. He's a very impressive figure. He's about 6'3" and muscular and handsome, and has a distinguished Caribbean accent, you know. And he appeared on Israeli television with us. We had a conference with the American ambassador over there, and the American ambassador condemned the very thing that we were over there to investigate. He said that it was against international law to take people from an occupied territory and deport them.
Wow.
It violates the Geneva Accords. So we had a press conference, and Wilhelm was our spokesperson, and he got on. There were only two TV stations at that time in Israel, and so everybody saw Wilhelm on television, and on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild and our delegation, he condemned this act of the Israelis. So, fast forward to the airport. We're leaving town, and we're at the airport. We're all standing around, and Wilhelm's about a head taller than the rest of us. And the guards at that airport descended on Wilhelm. It was
wow.
unbelievable. Who are you? Where are you going? Well, I'll show your passport. And so we all stood around Wilhelm to protect
yes.
him. And there was quite a fuss before they finally let him go. But I think that kind of singling out of people that don't look white and Jewish at the
yes.
airport is commonplace. And not surprising, you know, the Israeli company that organizes airport security over there
yes.
has been contracted to organize airport security in places like Boston
yes.
Here.
I know. It's very concerning. And as you observed, I mean, I guess their concern is, quote-unquote, terrorism happening, terrorist acts originating at Ben-Gurion Airport. But what the experience of leaving is, I mean, for me, I've left there a couple of times in the last year. And it's always about, we end up talking about where I had my bar mitzvah, you know, where I go to shul. So, I mean, it's a religious questionnaire. And, you know, heaven forfend if you should be a Muslim, which is why Muslims avoid that airport as much as they can. It's very concerning, very upsetting.
I understand that you met Jeff Halper, who heads the Committee Against House Demolitions, and he took you around. What did you see?
Well, I met Jeff a couple of times this trip. Jeff is, he studies the occupation and the West Bank and knows it in a very detailed, granular way. One of the things that he showed me that I found, a couple of things that are just sort of the devils in the details. He showed me this incredible suburban Israeli settlement in the heart of East Jerusalem, Palestinian areas, that looks like a suburban development in Westchester. And it has a beautiful brick sidewalk. And as you're leaving the settlement and going out into the Palestinian village that surrounds it, the sidewalk suddenly stops and there's trash on the side of the road and just dirt. And these are two communities that are both served by the Jerusalem Municipality. So you see apartheid before your eyes. You see a systematic difference for one community over another. And often that difference is established through a wall. So you see walls all through this community, too, that separate Jews and non-Jews. Another thing that he showed me was in the settlement of Male Adumim, a huge city, or not a huge city, a city, a very large settlement outside Jerusalem with fountains on a mountaintop with fountains and swimming pools and the like. He pointed out these 400- and 500-year-old olive trees that had been taken from Palestinian villages and transplanted into their traffic circles. So once again, you see this kind of humiliation, separation, different standards for one people and another. You know, Jeff says, you always know where a settlement is and where the village is because the village has these large black water tanks on top of their buildings. And that's because they get water reliably only 2 days a week, and they have to store water. Whereas the Jewish settlements in the same area get water on a very reliable basis and don't need these water tanks. So I guess one of the things that is just sort of staggering about this experience is that I call it, I mean, for lack of a better word, the blatancy of apartheid. Jeff says it's the banality of apartheid. But certainly when you go into the occupied territories, you see this incredible system of separation. You see walls that grab as much territory as they can and as few Palestinians as they can in order to segregate the Palestinians. And you think, why don't we know more about this over here? Well, when Jimmy Carter used the word apartheid 6 years ago, he was roundly dismissed in the American media for saying that. And I think that's one of the most disturbing things is that we are denying that. The Nation magazine did us a great service last year when a former Zionist named Stephen Robert, he may still be a Zionist, a leader in the Jewish community, went and saw what I saw. He came back and he said, "This is apartheid on steroids." That was a great act on his part and on the Nation's part. It is saying honestly what's going on. And the ability of so many people to confront this, to look at it, and just walk away without bearing witness, let alone just to lie about it, is staggering. And it's really hurting. We're denying a reality that's profound. In the South Africa situation, we didn't deny it. And this gives rise to Jeff Halper's great concern. He says that his concern is that we are moving from a South Africa model to an Algeria model. And what he means by that is in the South Africa model, there was were a lot of people who began to take up the cause in the liberal West, and they helped to reform this society without major violence. In this case, a lot of evidence is being presented to the West, and the West is denying it, or people are denying it in the discourse. And what you see on the part of activists, and I see activist friends there on a regular basis who have been working hard without that much sustenance from the West, you see a sort of hardening. And I don't hate Israelis. The society is contemptible in a lot of ways, but I see a separation and a hatred developing on both sides of this that Jeff fears will result in an Algeria situation in which there's ultimately there's bloodshed in which one side is absolutely determined that you have to leave this territory completely. And that's fearful. Here's a guy who's been there many, many years carrying on the good fight who says, we need more traction in your media. We need more attention. Mustafa Barghouti, a leader of the Palestinian nonviolent resistance, has said the same thing. We need traction. We need you to support us.
MondoWeiss.net. I read it on a daily basis.
Well, thanks, Michael.
It's part of my routine. You just do a fabulous job, Phil Weiss, and we thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Great.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.